Hello.
Hey.
I am getting... Oh, yeah. Did you want to do the intro?
No, you can
Sorry.
Do it.
Mine what is are you stupid. Getting? I'm getting pretty good at making steak.
Oh, hell yeah. That's not stupid at all.
Yeah. Well, it's from being selfish, which is, like, usually when Kyle goes out of town, I turn into, like, just a little rat who eats the same thing every day.
Like a lot of pasta, right, or something? Like
mostly spaghetti.
Pasta?
Yeah. Mostly spaghetti and pasta-based things. But then I was like, hold on. Well, wouldn't it be easier just to cook a big steak?
Mm-hmm.
It's not easier, but it lets you have a little more variety because then you're like, oh, what am I going to have on the side with the steak? And then you can play around with that.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm getting real good at ribeyes. So
hell yeah.
Just here to brag about it.
What is your technique? Our steak wants to know. What technique do you adhere? Which school, you know, school of magic, which school of steak are you?
Now, I learned from Kyle, so, you know, blame him if this is all wrong, but it turns out great pretty much every time. So I let the steak come up to room temp. Sometimes I get impatient and I don't do that all the way, but that's okay because I like my steaks pretty rare.
Some schools say you don't even have to do it, so.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So I do that. I dry them off.
That one's crucial across the board. Everyone agrees.
Yes. Got to have a Maillard reaction. Otherwise, what are you doing with steak?
You're steaming your steak crust, which
is
not good.
That's not right. And then you pack it with some salt and pep. It's ripping hot heat with avocado oil. It's been my go-to.
Yeah.
And then
just
sear it for a couple minutes, about 2 to 4 minutes, just kind of checking on it depending on the thickness, and then flip it. And then at this point is usually when I get impatient and I'm like, you know, I should probably let it sear, but fuck it, I'm gonna go ahead and add the butter anyway. So I add a little cube of butter, a pretty big cube of butter, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
And several garlic cloves, a couple sprigs of rosemary, and I start doing that chef-y basting technique.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me feel very fancy. And that's about it. I just keep checking the temp till it gets to like 112 ish. And then I take it out and let it rest.
Hell yeah. That's a deluxe basting classic cast iron.
Cast iron, yeah.
Yeah. That's a classic method. Awesome.
That's my go-to.
Nice. I was wondering, you know, because with Kyle, you got to probably have the equipment to do like sous vide, reverse sear, all
that
shit.
We do have sous vide. We do. But it's a pain in the ass to work the machine, so I don't. So
I've never done it that way.
Honestly, what we end up using that machine for most is like just if we buy meat and we're not going to use all of it, we just use it to like put things in the freezer.
Okay. To like back. Does it also do the vacuum seal stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
Okay. Mm-hmm. That way it doesn't get any freezer burn.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Anyway, this has been our bougie food talk.
I love it. steak is like a really good, I guess for me, it's a good out of town. Abby's out of town meal because Abby does not eat it. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, Kyle definitely eats it, but
yeah, I don't know. I could make a delicious steak, but Abby would be like you. So
yeah,
that's a me meal for sure. I do the same, roughly the same technique, I guess.
Yeah, I'm full of steak. I purposely only ate half of it so I would still be awake enough to do the show. So you're welcome.
Nice. I was doing grilling today. We had like a big link of sausage and. Like smoked sausage, you know, the one with just like a big curl. Not like individual links, but like some portobello mushrooms. I like
Yum.
To just put the big thing on there, like marinated in some soy sauce stuff. And
hell yeah.
Grilled veggies and some green onions, like just whole on the grill, you know?
Oh, I love a whole green onion.
Yeah.
Kyle, like one time I asked if like he was grilling and I was like, can you put some on there? And he's like, for what? And I was like, you know, just to eat them, just whole. He was really confused by this. I was like, you're not Mexican enough to understand
right,
this,
yeah.
I guess.
This is a Mexican thing, I guess.
Anyway, sorry if you're listening to this like right before lunch or something. You're very hungry now. Just hang in there.
Yeah. Eat vicariously through us.
Take an early lunch.
So if you follow us, you know that I am in education. I'm a teacher. So part of that, of course, part of the tried and true thing is giving quizzes because it's funny.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Okay. I think I know what this bit is and I'm excited.
Maybe, you know. So I give quizzes. And one of the things I give is a notes quiz.
That's open book?
it's open notes. Yeah. So it's basically an incentive to do your notes because you like, so, and here's why I am trying to be a jerk, but not like a useless jerk. The reason is that kids will come in and everyone's got different learning styles. And to some degree, well, okay, first, the science is actually a little wonkier than we've always been led to believe of, like, everyone's got certain learning styles that they're only good at. Actually, everyone's good at all of them, but in different
mixes. I'm sure your brain, like, is very plastic, too. You could probably get good at one of them if you tried.
You can get good at them. You have comfort zones in them, but, like, you're capable of learning in all of them. Anyway, people have preferences, right? And so some people, especially younger people, not to knock on you guys, sometimes are overconfident in their abilities of, oh, I can just like chill and listen and learn it all. And to some extent, you know, there's variability and some are better at that than others, but usually not to the extent that they think.
I will say, as a co-host to a fucking podcast, I forget like half of our episodes. I'm like, I know we talked about it, but I'm fucking like, for me, audio is good for getting the gist of stories. Like, yeah, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, here's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But like, for me to concretely remember stuff, it has to be like I'm reading it. Like, I have to visually see something, I think.
Yeah. And so that's another, you know, aspect of it is like writing, helping encode the memory, but also like then going back and reading over it to try to find the answers to the quiz. You know, there's a lot of more interaction with it. That's all I'm getting at. Not a total jerk, but anyway, so I do these, make sure they're taking the notes and stuff. It's open notes, 10 questions, multiple choice, super easy. But I like to include one Easter egg in each quiz, which is the stupid placement of an answer choice. That, yes, like, is never appropriate for the historical year until one specific time in the course when it will actually line up. But
oh, I like that you're planting it now, and eventually it will be the right answer.
Yeah, but oh, until then, good. It's just funny. Until then, the appearance of Richard Nixon as an answer choice in a world history course that starts all the way,
yeah,
in the ancient world is ridiculous. So which of
not
these
not going to come up for most of the course.
Yeah. So for example, my first notes quiz of the year was, which of these people was a Persian mathematician and cosmologist who developed a model of planetary movement that inspired the Copernican heliocentric model, blah blah blah, right? Correct answer, Nasir al-Din al-Tusi. Incorrect answer, Richard Nixon.
Richard M. Nixon. Okay, great.
The first time, you know, that quiz goes out and whatever. One poor kid picks it. And this is an AP class. And so I give it back to all of them, right? Uh-huh. And they're kind of comparing with each other. Just him, mm-hmm, and his friends there at the group. And they just roast him. They're just like, my man, Richard Nixon, seriously? And they actually sit like kind of in front of my desk. On the front of my desk, I have like the president's placemat.
Oh my gosh.
And one of them's like, he's like right over there. He's on the...
He's right there.
And they're just dogging this kid. So then when I give him the next one, you know, a while back, when they got him back, they were all like, oh, did you put Richard Nixon on that one? Because I also put him on there. Which medieval monk argued against bringing Greek philosophy into Catholicism? One of the options you could have put.
It's Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Very monk-like.
I am not a priest. I am a monk.
There's a difference, apparently.
So that's a stupid aside, but I've been doing that all year so far. I had one about an Ottoman Sultan. One option was Richard Nixon, the Ottoman, mm-hmm, Sultan. So I'm going to keep that up. And so far, only 2 out of 3 have been selected. That second one, the one with the medieval monk, no one picked him. He was left out.
He just doesn't look like a monk.
But the Ottoman Sultan, someone thought he was an Ottoman Sultan.
That's really good. I can't wait till it's the right answer and you're going to have all these kids like, shit.
It's not Richard Nixon.
You can go ahead and cross that one out. I've been trained to think, no, this is couldn't possibly be it.
Although my theory is that every kid that I get with this, when they get it wrong in that very embarrassing way, it's going to instill in them a lifelong hatred of Richard Nixon, right?
I like this plan. Yeah.
And you're like, fuck that guy. That guy, everyone laughed at me for picking him. He's an asshole. Sure, I was the one who picked him, but
he's got to be one of the more easily hateable presidents for sure.
You know, he's top of the list for most people just because he's like a jerk. In addition to having, you know, shitty policies, which lots of them have, he was like just abrasive. So, but Reagan ruined everything. Remember, so.
Ruined everything. That's my favorite. I tell people that all the time. Ruined everything.
So what's going on in the world or in your world?
Man, not much over here. I'm just plugging away at shit. I'm trying to read Dawn of Everything by David Graeber, and there's another guy on it. Sorry, other guy.
It's also a David, like Grennauer?
Well, it's on my fucking iPad. Let me just look. Yeah, David Wendrow. Here's the fucked up thing. In Libby, it does just say David Graeber, so sorry, Wendrow.
Damn.
It's only on, like, the cover. Okay. So, yeah, I'm about halfway through that, but I'm getting, like, library anxiety because, like, I only have 9 days left, and it took me, like, the rest of that loan to get halfway. So, I'm really...
You can't renew it?
I can, but there's also people waiting in line, so I don't know how that works.
Ah.
If they will let me renew it. If they will, that'd be rad, but then I feel bad. But also, like, I want to because otherwise I lose all my highlights. But
it's a big book. I mean, people are going to understand. Big. Like, they're going to, people waiting after you are probably going to renew, like, once.
I hope they do. This thing's fucking, I mean, it's 900 pages with notes, but, you know, without all the bullshit, it's like 780, still gigantic.
Without all the bullshit, there's a lot of good stuff in those footnotes.
I'm not going to read the footnotes. If it was that important, you would have put it in the book.
Well, I'm reading it too, but I'm reading the footnotes. But ooh. I'm also on like page 50 or something.
Exactly. No. It's very good. I like it. It just takes me, like, I feel like I'm just reading in really long chunks, but like not very consistently. So I'm a little worried. I'm not going to make it. I will say that's kind of like the joy of like going back to having a library card is like you do feel that pressure of like, oh no, like people are waiting on this. I got to finish it. Like you get like a little more motivated to read, I feel like.
Yeah, there's externalities that you're kind of accountable to.
It makes it fun. Like whenever like a title you've waited for a long time comes in, you're like, hell yeah, dude.
It gives you direction. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I also enjoy the book. I'm excited to, hopefully I can finish it and or renew the loan and finish it and type up some notes, maybe do an episode on it. Because it is very interesting and has a lot to say about basically what we talked about with Engels and the origins of the family kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Like civilization/human organization, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Graeber's cool. I mean, you know, we've referenced Graeber some. He's more anarchist than I am, but he's probably as anarchist as you are. I don't know. He's a cool guy.
Yeah, I like him. He did bullshit jobs too, right?
Yeah, that was him.
That was very formative for me, and I think that's a great entry point too for a lot of people because it, you know, pretty much anyone can relate to it.
Yes, exactly. Like you were, it's a tag yourself book. You're like, oh, there's my fucking job. There's my boss. You know.
Mm-hmm.
There's Denise from accounting. Like, everybody is in the fucking book.
Yeah, yeah. It came at me at the right moment, too. Like, it came whenever I was transitioning to work from home, and it came when I was, like, transitioning to being a communist. So it was very, like, cool.
Making lots of changes.
Yeah, making a lot of, just going to go ahead and change my gender while I'm at it. Fuck it. What's up with you?
Nothing too crazy. I mean, we're coming up on spring break. When we release this, I will be 2 days, one full day and one half day.
Wow.
Away from spring break and then a full week off.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'll be great. Fuck them kids.
Yeah, no, they get to enjoy a break too. So
yeah, for them. For real.
But really, it's for me. I mean, catching up in my, like, life and living it. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Kind of important.
Yeah, I was reading something, maybe it was in the journal, that said that, like, I'm from New York. It was in the journal, the Wall Street Journal, I guess, that they were talking about, like, why teachers are still leaving and shit.
I wonder fucking why.
Right. And it was just, I mean, just be on TikTok and the algorithm realizes you're a teacher and boom, there you go.
Yeah. You'll find out fast.
Or you know someone who's, you know, if you're interested in it. But yeah, they were like, not as many people are leaving as like last year was apparently the peak, but it's still a fucking lot. Yeah. So I guess it's still tough out there for those in the education world.
I mean, shit, who was that? What state legislator did... They made it so, like, using pronouns, you know, affirming pronouns in a way that doesn't line up with sex assigned at birth is, like, a fucking felony or something like that.
Whoa, I don't know if it's a felony, but I know Texas is pretty weird about it.
They said it's a... No. I think they were going to call it, like a sexual offense situation.
Whoa, like a sex crime?
Like, you're going to have to register as a fucking sex offender.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's find that out. I don't even know how to Google that. Teacher law pronouns.
That makes it sound like that's a 75-year-old.
All teachers boomer. Must have pronouns.
That's a boomer Google right there.
It really is. All right, Florida. That's December 13th. That's old. That's old news. I want new news.
Did someone recently do it?
I thought I'd seen it on the internet, so, you know. So that was Florida. They did it back in December. They're like, hey, fuck this. State law that prohibited teachers from using preferred pronouns in school, saying blah, blah, blah. And then new news, we have a Republican bill in Missouri that could imprison teachers who support transgender students. Super normal thing to do. Yeah, if the bill becomes law, teachers or school counselors who support a transgender student's transition could face a $10,000 fine, imprisonment, and may be forced to register as a sex offender.
Damn.
Yeah, what the fuck, man?
To be honest, if you're really going to actually try to make it, because like Texas and stuff and school districts were talking about it a little while back, and I was just like, well, okay, it's one of those things where it's, well, okay, I should say, I think it's really bad, but... there's a lot of initiatives and shit that schools do, and people I think familiar with education know that I don't know if it's half or I don't know the particular ratio, but lots of shit they tell us to do. We're like, oh,
you
okay,
just don't do.
Okay, fine, and then you just don't do it because it's too much stuff. So
see bullshit jobs.
Yeah, half the job is a little portion of the job is figuring out what do I have to do, what do I not, like any mm-hmm. job, you know. So
mm-hmm. I would say yeah.
So that's what was one where I was like, okay, fine, but I'm not doing that. I'm just going to be a human.
Yeah. If you have the resources to like be a fucking fly on the wall in the classroom to catch me using a pronoun, like that's a rare occurrence anyway, you know?
Yeah.
Like, okay. Good luck with your surveillance plan.
Right. And then you can come in and be like, oh, hey, sorry. But I mean, unless you're going to be watching me the whole time, like,
yeah, you can just be like, oh, I messed up. Like, there's no way you can prove this
yeah,
shit.
You could just be like, oh yeah, sorry.
Switched it, whatever.
It's like you or, you know, that person watching or like, you know, any older person. I feel like older people do this more often is like not really misgendering because it's an animal, but like they'll just use the wrong pronoun for like a cat or something.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And then they'll just like immediately correct it. You could just, you know,
oh, yeah.
Just be like, oh yeah, that was so sorry. You know, happens all the time. You do that.
Dude, if dog owners could get with pronouns as much as they do their own dog's pronouns, like we'd be set. Like if the fucking, if the cis people of the world respected trans people as much as they do their pets, we'd be in a good situation.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of the, like a dog, you know, pejorative sort of thing. Please, gender us like a dog, please.
Please gender me like your dog. Please defend me when someone calls me the wrong thing. Actually, you can see by their collar. That is a non-binary dog.
All right. I've been reading some news, though. There's some funny shit out there.
All right. Tell me some funny news. That was bad news. Tell me funny news.
All right. So we want funny news. I think that's good. We also have plenty of bad news, I guess, but...
Oh, for sure.
This is, like, a funny part of the bad news, I guess. Or
okay,
it's like,
okay.
It's related to the election, which I feel like is bad news.
It's bad, but it is also funny. I'm not going to lie.
All right. Here's, it's just funny from the get-go. It's a story in the Times. They go and they talk to a lot of people. You know, a little human interest story here about the election. The headline, Joe Biden's super fans think the rest of America has lost its mind.
So what are we talking about here? His, I'm trying to think who would even, I guess his staffers that are fucked up 90% of the time, like his staffers who are also taking uppers. So like two people.
You're wondering what demographic are we talking about here?
Yeah. Like who is a super fan?
Well, they found a few people. The subheadline is bewildered by tepid enthusiasm for a president they see as transformative.
Transformative? These Democrats. Like, yeah, he's transforming into a corpse before our very eyes. That's pretty transformative.
Joseph R. Biden, transformative president. These Democrats occupy a lonely space in U.S. politics. One of them quoted as saying, I feel like I'm the only one.
Okay.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, I wonder fucking why.
So they go and they interview these people, and most of the people they interview are old. You know, old retired person. You know, she's hanging out with her cat. She's like saying, oh, you know, I imagine, you know, Biden would fit right in here. She lives in like South Philly or something. She's like, I can picture him coming by or going up to him saying, hi, Joe. And just like, oh, he seems like a nice guy, basically.
Is that a requirement for being president?
Being a nice guy?
I feel like it's an anti-requirement.
Well, yeah. In like, actually being honest, yeah, you do have to be able to like commit war crimes, which he is. I mean, he does.
You know, he does do
that. Genocide. But I guess maybe he's nice and delusional enough to forget that side of himself. talks to someone else who says they are as eager to vote for Mr. Biden as she was for Barack Obama in 2008.
I want whatever she's on.
Right. To feel that way again.
That's wow. Kinda cool. To feel hope again. What a world.
However misguided, it'd be nice. Well, just in general. I mean, like, because there was a poll this week or very recently that came out that was like just that just trashed Biden, basically. It was just like Trump is ahead of him by maybe 5 points or something. And most of the people who are voting for him are like, this sucks. Whereas, you know, Trump doesn't really have that problem, I guess. Everyone's like, we wish we had someone else to run for, basically. And that's within people who are like accepting the system. I mean, how many people
who are still going to do it?
Right. Yeah. How many people, because polling is so messed up that like you're only getting people who are willing to talk to fucking strangers on the phone.
Which is nobody.
Right. No one under like 30. They talked to someone who said, oh, there was a younger person too. There was this guy who is like the chair of the Davidson Democrats in Nashville.
What does that mean?
Dakota Galbin, like the Democratic Club, I guess. It's a county party organization based in Nashville.
Okay.
So the county Dem guy, but he's like 28.
Why? Why is he doing that with his time?
He loves Mr. Biden. And I feel like I'm the only one, he said, arguing that the news media had overwhelmingly focused on his tepid support. Does anybody care that I exist?
Oh, that just sounds like a personal issue, just man. Like people care.
Yeah. You're a cool guy. I mean, you're doing something profoundly uncool.
Super uncool, actually. I wouldn't like you. I'm sure there are people in your life that do like you and care that you exist. I'm probably not one of them. Oh,
he, like many of Biden's fans, say, yeah, okay, he doesn't generate enthusiasm, but they argue that's a positive thing. His strength isn't in his energy, they say, but his management skills and his understated ability to get things done.
Okay, that's like half of what a president does is like get people riled up.
Yeah, like especially, I don't know, these days when you're not even doing any backroom legislating or anything, you're just solely on TV.
You're just ceremonial.
Yeah. There is this one person who keeps a list. Oh, this person is 34. works, but they work for a lobbying firm in Philadelphia.
Oh, they're not a real person. Okay.
It's a political friend of his, a committee member in the city's second ward also. So like,
okay, yeah.
They're getting real deep to find people who are, but anyway, she keeps like a list in her notes app of Mr. Biden's accomplishments.
Wow.
And it like, they have a picture, she's scrolling through it and it's like talking about some stupid bill that he passed or something, signed this bill, did that.
What other person in your life would you have to keep a list of their accomplishments with you to prove that they don't suck? Imagine having to do that for a friend, a spouse.
Right.
So, you know, anybody. Like,
you have the why I'm not smothering the house in your sleep or something list.
Yeah. Like well,
they,
what?
Their smile is nice.
Like, they if you have to remind yourself physically with a note of why someone doesn't suck, it sounds like maybe they suck.
Well, even maybe you don't think they do, but you know, so many other people are so misguided.
That's the thing. That's the real
the conceit
hubris
of, yeah.
of these people is like they're the whole like the quotes too, like what's wrong with everybody? Why am I the only one? Like if you have to ask yourself that so many times, like, I mean, I don't know. I'm a fucking communist. I ask that all the times.
But it's good to see the shoe on the other foot. It's good to see these people like fucking pulling their hair out. Being like, why
get
can't people
alienated.
Tell? This person said, I don't see it as a choice between two bad candidates. I couldn't be more honored to vote for Biden.
Honored.
This is the person I think that keeps a list. She says, he's done so much. It's driving me crazy that people don't see it. But that's kind of like what we say. I mean, like, capitalism has done so much evil in the world. It's driving us crazy that people don't see it.
Very true.
There's one guy. I love it. So he's also they got a bunch of Philly people, I think. Like, Philly politically connected people. This dude Jim Donnelly is the leader of the 58th ward in the city's conservative leaning northeast, and he says he's gotten into fights with his neighbors who have vandalized or stolen his lawn signs.
Gotten into fights,
which I mean, like, a Philly, okay, so I would say anywhere, most other places, if I hear that from an old guy, I'm thinking he yelled at his neighbor, like, you're right, like,
mm-hmm. You're making this up or something. You're really over exaggerating,
right? Or like, he just means I got in a fight, like I got in an argument,
a verbal fight. Yeah,
but like, I don't know, I'm picturing you like fucking punch somebody or,
yeah, okay. Philly's kind of a different story there.
Yeah, if someone says they got in a fight, maybe they mean it.
I mean, listen, I have been walking in my neighborhood almost every day for the past like 2 months, and my neighborhood is very it's a mix of like white liberals and like Mexican and black families. I have seen nary a sign for this man. Like zero. I don't think I've seen a single sign for this man in the entire city and suburbs of DFW.
That's crazy.
Like, I've seen some Trump ones, like, in some of the suburbs, but, mm-hmm. like, I don't think I've seen shit for him. And, like, to put it in context, like, my neighborhood, like, these are the people that have the, you know, we believe in science mm-hmm. signs. Like, they're dyed-in-the-wool liberals, you know? Like, they're probably going to hold their noses and do it, but I'm just saying, like, that's the level of unenthusiasm we're working with here.
It's, I don't know, I think the kids would say these days that he's probably cooked.
I think he's cooked. I read a conspiracy tweet that they might be prepping Kamala.
To do what?
To take over.
Like?
To be on the ticket instead. They gave her that big speech about Palestine, and there was other citations, but that I got bored and didn't read. Great reporting from the scene.
All she said about Palestine was she wanted a ceasefire, right? Or that they should do a ceasefire?
Yeah. She didn't do shit, but...
Okay.
People acted like it was a big deal because it's like, wow, you're like not calling actively for more violence. So I guess that's good. The bar is very low.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, regardless, she's part of the administration. She's a lunatic anyway.
Oh, for sure.
She's terrible.
No, she also sucks, but we're going to get, it'll be even more annoying if that's the case. We're going to get guilted so fucking hard.
How much would the machine start churning about her? Or like, I feel like people are going to be less enthusiastic for Biden because of the age factor. He's just a white guy.
I'm telling you, if she gets in there, it's going to be all, this is so historic. It's the first woman president. It's the first black woman president. Like, you have to fucking do it. Like, there's going to be 1,000 puff pieces written about her. She's going to be on every fucking podcast, everything. Like, she's going to be everywhere.
But I feel like just she hasn't, she's been a thoroughly, I mean, like, the bar is pretty low, like, for being a vice president. Like, Biden was considered a fine, like a decent, you know, a serviceable vice president, did the job, didn't do shit. He was, you know, just more like, you know, what, 10 years more cognizant or whatever than he is now. That's all he had to do, is just be there. Like, she's
be a body.
Notably bad at being vice president. She's always strung out on shit and everything else, like loopily saying stuff. Just like, the only news she ever gets is bad news.
I agree, but she also has a weird amount of stands, so I don't know. I think it's going to get weird if that's the case.
I do want to stick with, though, that I think they're going to stick with Biden. They're just going to, you know, tough it out, prop him up, do whatever.
I don't know. I'm going to call my cold shot. I'm going to say they're going to replace him.
Like, he's still going to be alive and they're going to replace him?
Yeah, I think he's going to be like, after careful consideration, you know, I promised to be a one-term president, so I'm doing it, and blah, blah, blah.
Dude, what if he, like, didn't do anything like that until the convention? Like, he strolls in there, and he's like, surprise, guys,
for voting
I'm giving
for me.
It to Kamala. That'd be wild.
That'd be really funny. I mean, it could happen, is a thing.
That's probably the best way to do it, because, like, the novelty factor would, like, people would be like, oh, hell yeah, that was cool that y'all did something at a convention. Like, it wasn't just a big waste of money. I mean, it would still be, but...
It was definitely, or will be.
But
don't worry, we're still going to waste a bunch of money.
Of, I don't know. So that's, yeah, those are the, speaking of crazy, those are the people that are like, hell yeah, I want to go vote for Joe Biden. They're going to be disappointed if that happens.
I can't imagine. We are to the point now, like, so do you remember, like, a few weeks ago. What is time? Where I joked about, like, this is like choosing between Hitler and whoever went against Hitler.
Yeah.
I found out, like, the guy who went against Hitler, like, appointed Hitler.
Oh, what's his face?
Hindenburg.
Von Papen. Oh, Von Papen convinced Hindenburg to appoint him, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, truly, that's where we're at.
That was for president, yeah, Hindenburg.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm not going to vote for a genocider. Like, what are you going to do?
We're going to scold you relentlessly. Don't you believe in America?
Not really.
I always tell my students when I'm doing any sort of, like, polling or something, because, like, sometimes we'll play this game called Blook It. It's a little review game thing on, you know, you play it on the iPad, but you play it all, like, collaboratively. And there's different, like, game modes you can play. Same set of questions, but, like, oh, you do different things with it, whatever. Tower defense or this sort of thing or whatever. And I like to let them vote on what game they play, you know, when we do that. And I always tell them, you can vote, you know, vote for whatever you want. But of course, you know, you're an American, so it's your right not to. You can always not vote.
That's true. Time and true honored tradition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. So I've been watching. my husband is just rapidly becoming an old man. I'm like, listen, we have to have a child because you are already a dad. He is watching a lot of History Channel documentaries. And I don't mind, though, because it's great just to, like, have on in the background while I'm drawing or just generally not paying attention. But it is really interesting to watch. Like, we did one on, there's FDR. We did one on Lincoln. And, like, there's these, like, mini-series, like, bio documentaries, basically. I mean, it really all comes down to, like, the great man theory in so many ways. Like, there's always these interviews of, like, imagine the courage it took to do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny with Lincoln, because the whole time, like, the first entire, like, episode out of, like, three episodes, they're like, Lincoln did not want to end slavery. Like, they said it, like, 10 times, you know, like, over and over. And then by the end of it, they're like, wow, what a change maker. Like, I was like, no, this guy had to be dragged kicking and fucking screaming into this.
Right, like the country split into two. Like, part of the country said, hey, man, fuck you. You're going to end slavery, like, while he was promising them not to end slavery. And so
it was really, it was super weird. And, you know, Obama was in it and saying the same shit of just like, wow, such courage.
Like 600,000 Americans, like, and, you know, half of them traitors, but still, you know, died in a conflict to, you know, to hammer that out. And he's just like, even then was like, okay, what do we have to do to change this? And there was some intellectual, like, movement by him. I don't want to say he was just stuck in the mud the whole time. But he took a lot of convincing.
He took a long time, like, based on what I saw there. Like, it was several years for him to go to. And I still think at the end, he was still, like, not viewing black people as equal. Like, there was no way he was going to try to fight that fight. He was just like, okay, fucking fine, I'll do it.
No, yeah. I mean, there was a spectrum for sure. And I think that he made it past some of his contemporaries in terms of social equality. But definitely, he was not, like, a full equality sort of person.
Well, I didn't know about the fucking colonization plan where he wanted to send all the black people to, like, somewhere in Central America.
Central America? I thought they were doing, like, Africa. They did that, too?
I think it was... They were planning on that as well. Let me see.
With those sorts of questions, it definitely matters, too, who you're talking about. I mean, when white supremacists are... or people who just broadly support some form of white supremacy in America, you know, advocate it. That's shitty. You know, but you also have figures like Marcus Garvey and stuff who were advocating back to Africa as, like, a, you know, a positive thing for, you know, for black people from, you know, I don't think that I wouldn't level the same criticism at them, but at, you know, people like Lincoln jumping on it, like, you know.
It's a different vibe, yeah. Right? Like, you can't.
It's
just,
like, let's,
you know,
go back to Africa versus get the fuck out of it.
Yes, like, yes. You know. Let's see. I found so that apparently there were proposals to have them move to a certain province of Panama. Oh, wow! According to one person's plan, the former slaves would work on a cotton plantation. Great. So keep doing that. We love that part of it.
Whoa.
After the end of their 4-year work contracts, they would be given 16 acres of land and the wages they had earned over that period. So, like, all right, no more slavery, but just, like, a little bit more slavery. This was an idea from, oh, his name is just, is that his name? Are you sure that's his name? It says Cock, but it's with a K, you know, an extra K, K-O-C-K.
Oh, like, that's like the Koch brothers.
Well, no, that's K-O-C-H, no?
Oh, yeah. But this is K-O-C-K.
K-O-C-K, Cock.
That's good.
Who is this? Bernard Cock, an entrepreneur in Florida, cotton planter. Yeah, he apparently signed a contract with Lincoln, like, to try to figure out this plan.
Yeah, that was a guy. Washington Post writes about him.
Yeah, that was a guy. But anyway, so, like, even in the documentary, it's really funny, like, Kyle and I were just cracking up with horror because they showed, like, this engraving of, like, you know, this white kind of Victorian looking man shaking hands with, like, these thankful black people. It was really weird. Like, okay, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Ugh. Anyway, it's been really weird having those documentaries just on in my house. It's that, and then there's also a series on, like, great inventions, which that one drives me crazy because it's cool. They're telling you the story of, like, these different guys racing to, you know, invent, you know, good tractors and, like, the first passenger airplanes and shit like that. And it's interesting stuff. But what sucks is they splice in, like, little comments from interviews with, like, CEOs and shit. And they're all like, it's all about innovation.
Yeah, fucking just, like, morons.
Really adding 0% to the show, like, negative adding to the show.
That's the big downside of America, the story of us, besides its, like, historical take on things, like, its analysis is shit, but, like, it does have cool reenactments and, you know, gives you easy history class sort of clips of stuff, right?
That's what I like about these kinds of documentaries. Like, yeah, I agree. Analysis is terrible, but it's interesting in the facts part of it.
Yeah. And then, like, of the analysis, just, like, even the historians, everyone they're talking to is, like, generally giving you just a complete bourgeois take on it. The tier below that is who you're talking about, the CEOs and everyone else. I think they interviewed Trump
oh my
back
God.
Before he was president or anything. He was just a rich guy. Mm-hmm. They interview like the guy who founded Wikipedia.
Oh my gosh.
Michael Douglas, I want to say. They interview him for like playing the president at some point. You know, like,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You know who he should play is Andrew Jackson. He looks like him.
Oh yeah.
Oh, just fluff that hair up a little bit more.
Especially now he's got to be fully in his Andrew Jackson era. Like,
dude, I think we're due for a weirdly sympathetic biopic of Andrew Jackson. I could see it. I could see it happening.
People are, yeah, he's complex and...
like, oh, he was neurodivergent. Or something, you know?
Well, yeah, he certainly he probably had, was, like...
you know, he's neurospicy.
Bipolar of some sort.
Yeah.
Although I have no historical accounts of the manic side of that, or, you know, the positive side. Just the...
just the depressive side?
Yeah, anger oh, the management, rage side. You know? Yeah, it's hard-pressed. Sometimes I've searched for stuff like this of, like, what's a good, like, what are good leftist documentaries or, good, you know, leftist historical, you know, movies or whatever about whatever topic, and they're mm-hmm. few and far between. Generally speaking, when you're making media like this, you've got a essentially liberal take on it, you know?
Yeah, I think it comes down to you can get some documentaries on individual strike actions because I think people feel comfortable painting that picture for one incident of like, look how bad that was, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's excessive, like it's capitalism run amok or something.
Yeah, and for anything larger, it's just podcasts. So, let's see. I found an interesting term.
An interesting term, okay.
Yeah, I mean, this was on fucking Twitter, so, you know, your mileage might vary. But according to this tweet, and I did some quick Googling around just to see if this was real. Have you heard of a whistle-stop strike?
No, I've only heard of a whistle-stop tour.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what kept coming up when I was Googling whistle-stop, which is like, that's just, you take breaks so you don't have to sit the whole time on a train.
Mm-hmm.
But a whistle-stop strike is when the you have like a union shop and the guy in charge, like the steward or whatever, would blow a whistle whenever someone notices an unsafe condition or a boss being a dick, and everyone just drops their tools until management fixes it.
So you're at work, but you're just repeatedly stopping the day every time someone's an ass?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like this is some cat or dog level reinforcement training here. Like, no. I'm not going to give any attention to that bad behavior. I'm just going to stop what I'm doing.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I love this. To me, this is like a more passive way of, not passive, but like a different way of doing the yell at your boss idea from like the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, apparently that like is a thing.
It's like that combined with a sit-down strike, you know, because you're preventing them from replacing you with somebody because you're at work. I mean, you're there in the office. You're just not being a very good employee from their perspective.
So this is, again, one of those many cool things that got kneecapped by labor laws in the United States. So our favorite, the National Labor Relations Act, bans secondary strikes, which this is kind of considered a secondary strike.
Really? How is it a secondary strike?
I don't know. This is according to, I'm reading a podcast transcript from Behind the Bastards, which I've heard is a very good show.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, apparently this is considered like an intermittent stoppage or something. Mm. So
okay. Yeah. I mean, it is that.
It is a work stoppage, so.
I just didn't think it was secondary in the sense that it wasn't like.
It's not a sympathy strike.
Right, yeah. Which is their language for, you know, the lead up steps to a general strike.
Yeah, that's their language for shit, things getting real.
Yeah. But, I mean, what we should do is just do it anyway.
I mean, it sounds good.
The fucking Soviets sitting around like, gee, is it legal for us to take the streets of Petrograd? Like, do you think they're going to get mad at us if we protest the Tsarist government?
There is a whole group of people so obsessed with legality, though.
I know. It does make sense in the personal, okay, it makes sense if you consider the class relations of people, I guess. Like if you consider the most of the time, if people are spending most of their energy talking about what they would do in situation X, and I'm including us here, you know, the bourgeois intellectuals or what have you, they're not making a workplace decision about, am I going to take certain means to try to, you know, protect my, you know, economic well-being. That's not the decision they're making. They're making hypothetical ones, you know. And so you have the comfort of figuring out, well, okay, you know, what moral stance would I take? What, you know, would best abstractly advance my overall philosophy or, you know, abstract connection to a movement or whatever, versus somebody who's like really thinking like, will this help me get a contract? Will this help us win a strike? Will this help us build a union? Will this help us build a movement? Like, people with those questions are going to like have a different calculus, I think, than someone who's like going through an exercise and they're thinking like, oh, is this, does this follow the letter of this law? You know?
Yeah. There's a big difference between a, you know, you're not in the middle of it. You're not like, you're not in the workplace that desperately needs a strike to happen, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, like it's very hard to visualize what that would actually be like, I think.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's kind of the flip side of that is, though, you know, people also have justifiable fears when they're in that situation too. And they may be like, you know, I don't want to do anything illegal because that could come back on me if we're not successful.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, even things like immigration status can affect that, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, kind of the converse of that, of like, sometimes it's easier for us to be like, why don't y'all just fucking get in the streets and do a general strike? Come on, you know?
Come on, guys.
And it's like, yeah, but it's not your ass getting fired, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I've got a little bit of labor news from the email.
Ooh.
This was a listener email, and this person was telling us about Open Air Workers United, which is a teachers union. They're organizing under the CWA 7777 in Denver. They went to management with their mission statement and demanded recognition, and they immediately closed the school and sent the kids home, which was totally illegal to do.
Wow.
And that probably helped them because they were like, oh, shit, we weren't supposed to do that. So later that day, the administration chose to recognize the union, and their next step is contract negotiation. This is the first private preschool to go union in the Denver metro area. This is just a little note from a fan of the show, and like, congrats, and thank you for letting us know about this. This is so cool.
Fuck yeah, that's awesome. Keep it strong. You know, congrats for that initial win. You know, you did get lucky that they fucked up that way, and you just got to keep pushing them. You know, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. They have an Instagram if you want to check them out. They're at Open Air Workers United. If you're in the Denver area, you want to throw them some support, go do it.
Yeah. The next time their contract negotiations come up, they may, you know, maybe they don't close the school down and they get cocky. The admin does, and they're like, oh, we don't have to cave this time, we're going to get our, you know, all the those concessions, we're going to get them back, and they might need a strike fund.
Keep an eye out. Support teachers.
Support teachers, yeah. Even the mean ones.
Anything else on the docket? I feel like we're just kind of like, we got a light sketch today.
We're jumping around. I do have a couple other news items. One of them is stupid and bleak. One of them is just bleak.
Start with bleak.
Let's just start with bleak. Well. Okay.
Yeah, we'll ease our way out of this.
This was in the Wall Street Journal from March 1st by Melanie Evans, talking about patients getting letters warning that they risk losing their doctors. Patients are getting ominous warnings in their mail and inboxes. They are about to lose insurance coverage for their doctors. The threatening letters and emails have sent patients reeling. They're like all calling the doctors, trying to figure out what the fuck to do. They are caught in the middle of unusually fierce and public contract disputes this year. Sparring in New York City are health insurers such as Giants United Healthcare and Aetna, which pay for medical care, and big name hospital systems seeking more money for the treatment provided by their doctors. Basically, in America, the way our system is...
In case you don't know, in case you're lucky enough not to know.
Everyone is forced to buy health insurance from private companies. And those insurance companies agree on these rates with these hospitals. Well, that actually makes it sound too mom and pop. They negotiate the deals with like hospital networks and like big fucking corporations that run huge swaths of hospitals, systems. And they negotiate the rates of pay and everything. And basically it works to where the doctors charge, you know, a certain pretty astronomical rate for insurance covered things in that network. But then they charge like a, like fall out of your chair laughing rate if you're not in the network. It's even crazier. Now they're demanding more money for the doctors, the hospitals are, and probably also for the hospital executives, and all those very useful people. And the insurance companies don't want to pay that. So the hospitals are sending letters to regular people saying, hey, you're just a person who wants healthcare, but you're not going to get to go to your doctor if your greedy insurance company doesn't pay our hospital executives more money.
Wow.
So that's like how a normal country would run things, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally, totally.
You would just be
super okay with that.
A regular human not involved in this at all, just getting dragged in saying like, hey, just so you know, your insurance company needs, you know, you need to get mad at them so that they will pay, you know, some of our guys more money.
Dude, I recently had a conversation with a healthcare worker and like, it was horrifying how many times in that conversation I could just be like, this is just wrong. This is just greed. This is just capitalism. Like the whole time it was like everything from, you know, we've talked about it before, how many patients you're supposed to see, to kinds of treatments that like they're encouraged to push, you know, kinds of tests they're encouraged to push because it makes them more money. Like so many instances of that. The lack of infrastructure in our healthcare is insane. Like the disconnect between, so this person works like at an urgent care facility. And so the disconnect between like having patients coming in and having to tell them like, hey, you need to follow up with a general, you know, practitioner or whatever, or, you know, a specialist or whoever. And like, they just can't fucking do it because they don't have insurance. They can't afford it. Like there's just so many of those instances where like the gaps in the system are so wide that so many people only go to the doctor if it is a true emergency.
Yeah. That's terrible health outcomes for everybody. Like for the people suffering, it's bad for the doctors who, I mean, they're like trained, they're smart people. They are taught like how to prevent conditions and shit, you know, like they know that shit. And the system drives them into just basically shitty crisis management because they're only getting people at the very worst, you know, ends of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It just sounded like this person was prevented from doing a good job of care so many times, mm-hmm. just due to how the system is set up. And I don't know, and this person is so passionate about their job too, that it was like very difficult to hear of like, damn, like you really give a shit about your patients and like are not able to help them in so many different ways. Like that's fucking frustrating.
Yeah. That is really bad right now. Like it's probably worse than it's been. And most times in our history, you know, barring maybe the before medical advancements and shit, you know,
barring bloodletting.
Right. Yeah. In modern times, it's probably the worst it's been. One of the sad things I think about it is it's probably only going to get worse. I mean, like there are not very many trends that are pointing in the direction of any sort of moderation of capitalism in the near to medium term.
No, doesn't seem like it.
The consolidation of like corporate power, the increasing push to find new frontiers of profit, like what they used to call the dwindling, the declining the tendency of the rate of profit to, like, it's increased to decline or something. There's a complicated way to say it, but basically it's like diminishing returns, basically. So when, you know, as a capitalist kind of increasingly face that, you know, that's why we're getting so much advancements in AI and stuff, is they're trying to find new ways to get blood from a stone, to get something for nothing. If they do succeed at, you know, mass marketing, like that, those Apple Vision Pro things,
yeah,
you know, and finally getting more people into that metaverse type looking stuff. I mean, they're going to be ripping people off left and right in that too. Like, they're just trying to find new avenues for profit out of not producing anything. Like, it's, I think the analysts in like the 70s and 80s and stuff, when we were deindustrializing, would refer to it as like the financialization of capital, is how they would call that initially. And I think we're maybe in like the latest of those stages, where now we've moved on past just like plain ass banking and financial instruments and shit. And now we're on to exotics, like, I don't know, selling people things that aren't things, you know, just like, I mean, in this case, this is just a legal kind of form of extortion. Just, we're just going to charge them more and bully their customers into accepting it. Like, they're just, it's going to keep getting worse, I think, in that regard, maybe.
Yeah, it does feel like they are running out of things to monetize. And so I agree. I think they're looking for just whole new areas of exploitation. I don't know. Like, there's just so many instances of it. Like, I was traveling recently and I was trying to, you know, log into a streaming service and it was like trying to stop me. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Just fucking let me watch this thing that I pay for.
Yeah.
You know, because it didn't recognize the address. And it was like, oh, you can only change it 4 more times this year. And I was like, so I can only try. You're sorry, Hulu, you're now telling me how many times I can travel?
Right. It's so crazy. Like,
what the fuck?
Because I think that they, yeah, some of those at least, they're like cool on a mobile app or something. But then if you're on a TV, they're like, fuck you.
That was the problem, yeah. Because I can use it on my iPad, I can use it on my phone. But yeah, I was trying to,
like, your screen is too big.
This screen cannot work with this app. I wonder about this a lot. And I wonder about this because, you know, in conversations with our parents, you know, they're of the mind of like, oh, it's always been bad. It's just like people are more talkative about it, you know, like we're more connected, so we hear more about it. But I'm just like, I don't know, man. It feels kind of different. Like, I even think of it in terms of like, even just like what we mentioned with the person who feels like they're in 2008, which, like, fucking good for you. I'd love to get back some of that positive feeling about the world. Like you said, yeah, it was definitely fucked and not accurate, but it was something, you know?
To me, it's almost in hand with the cultural malaise that people talk about, like on social media and shit, of, and we've mentioned before of how, I think we've mentioned on the show before, of how like culture seems to essentially, you can't tell decades apart anymore. And it's like kind of stagnated into a, everything from 2000s to now is just kind of meh, it's there. It's almost like that of like, there's no direction. There's no future. I don't know. There's no like vision of what that would be or goal of what that would be.
It's yeah, just, I am not seeing a path forward of progress. You know what I mean? Like, and maybe that's like, I'm projecting onto past times that they had that. I don't know. I think they did, just because I watch a lot of sci-fi. And so I can see, you know, what people's visions were for the future, you know, and mm-hmm. I can see, okay, here's what their values were. Here's what they were into. Like, it was all exploration. It was relatively egalitarian until we get to, like, I would say the 2000s and everything had to get gritty. I'm not seeing that thread anymore, you know, of like a, oh, we're working towards this thing. We feel like we're going to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like we're at the point of like, maybe someone will make an app about this thing, but we're not going to solve the fucking problem. Like, no one's talking about fucking curing cancer. That's like not a news thing anymore. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I know that's obviously there are people who are still working on it, but like, I feel like that used to be a thing more of like, hey, we're going to do this thing, like global initiative. We're going
to
do it.
There used to be more overt, more societal wide, like, yeah, like goals or missions.
Yeah. I mean, like the space race, I read somewhere that that actually was not very popular in the United States, which I did not know. And I'm sure it was varied, but two sources used the word moondoggle, which I think was really funny. Yeah, this is from The Atlantic. The forgotten opposition to the Apollo missions.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of expensive.
Support for the moon landing has increased the further we've gotten away from it. So in 1989, 77% of the people thought it was worth it. In 1979, only 47% of people thought it was worth it.
Well, if you're landing on the moon in 1969, I mean, you're 1 year out from the Tet Offensive, from the Democratic Convention of 60. I mean, like, the country was pulling apart at the seams in 68. You know, a year later, you're on the moon, you're like, okay, you know, last year we shot Martin Luther King, like, an RFK.
That's true. Like, the shit is not going well.
And now we're on the moon, but like, what are we doing? You know?
Yeah. You could see that as like a, guys, what are we doing here?
A few years later, Nixon resigns in disgrace. They pardon him. Like in 79, you're like, what was that? What was all of that?
Yeah, I can't get the rest of the article because I don't fucking subscribe. But I wonder what it was like right at the time, you know, because I think
the day of it had to be pretty cool, right?
Oh, for sure. Everyone's like, I fucking love the moon.
Yeah.
You have people like, I've always wanted to go to the moon, you right. know, like trying to cover it up.
I've been talking about going to the moon for years.
But like 70s, yeah, you're right. 70s American, much more cynical. You're like, I've fucking seen Vietnam and Nixon and all this shit. Fuck the government. I'm not going to say they did anything good.
Yeah. So that makes sense. And then as you just keep seeing the government be dumb as hell, then you might be like, well, I don't know. The moon, they could do that. That was cool. But with something that is so complex that only all of the wealthy countries in the world are able to easily solve it, like for a tenth of the price that we pay, you know, hopefully they find some sort of way out on this very complicated healthcare question.
It feels like we're in a people churning machine of like, guys, you know, if you just took care of this, like people would live and they would also do more of that work thing you're obsessed with. And at this point, they're like, no, it's just easier to like let them die and just make people have more babies.
Because there's two parts to that, I think. Because part of it is, yeah, you're right that you're probably just going to have a healthier workforce. A workforce that's better able to socially reproduce and, you know, provide you with more profits and what have you. So in that sense, the system is not even healthy enough to perpetuate itself.
And that's why you're seeing this big rise of like trad wife content and all that shit, because they're like, oh, we need to pump the idea that it's cool to have a bunch of babies.
I saw something interesting along those lines about the trad wife stuff. They were pointing out that there's some video on TikTok. They're pointing out that like the trad wife content, they almost are never focusing on something unglamorous. They're always focusing on like something that's ostentatious and kind of unnecessary to do. Like, not unnecessary to do. Like, they're producing food or something, but like, they're never doing something that is drudgery but necessary, like laundry.
No, they're always like, the ones I've seen are like making Oreos from scratch and right. goldfish and all the shit.
To this extent of like, not necessary to do in the sense that you could just buy that or what have you. Like they're like, I guess ostentatious in the sense of like needlessly making something from scratch. Like why it's just like conspicuous consumption of time and effort.
Yes. Yes. And you know, their kitchens are perfectly cleaned and they're wearing a really nice dress for some reason and jewelry, you know, we're just going back to the 50s again for some reason.
But except for kind of not. I mean, the 50s, really one of the cool things about that, I think people felt at the time. I think nowadays we're like, ew, basically, is how many like canned and processed things there were that it was like, because you were, I don't know, that's you were true. Still selling a consumer identity. And maybe that's, it's just a different flavor of the consumer identity, but it's like, at that time it was convenience. It was like, we get mm-hmm. that you have to do this shit. You know, you probably do think it kind of sucks, but hey, like you can provide for your man by, you know, doing this, but like kind of easy, you know, it's in a box.
That's true. And now like there's this weird, like you said, yeah, conscious time obsession of like, yeah, take all day to make homemade PB&Js, including the bread. You know?
Yeah.
Like who has fucking time for that?
I don't know. This, what was our initial thread on the tragedy stuff? I got derailed on that.
Oh, we're just, the healthcare thing. It's easier just to make more babies.
Yeah. To me, the analysis there is like the pathological, like it's the self-destructive, I should say, drive of capitalism in this current stage to like saw off its own limbs to swim a little faster, you know? It's
yeah.
like short term. It's just the next quarter's returns. If we have to, you know, feed a quarter of the workforce into a wood chipper to realize those profits, that's what we're going to do. And we'll worry about, you know, the problem of the next three quarters is someone else's problem. We'll cash out by then. Like everyone is just cashing out at all times. It's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. I think on a climate level, I think on a healthcare level, the mood seems to be, fuck it, I got mine.
Yeah, and it's a completely deranged way of looking at it. I mean, more deranged than the Biden superfans. Like, seriously, your healthcare system is like...
It's actively killing people.
Right, it's accidentally doing some healthcare. Like it does healthcare as a sideshow. You know, it's
sometimes.
Right. It's it's a little worm you put on the end of the hook. But the hook is let's make sure that this makes money for shareholders. It, like this article literally says this basically. It's like, oh yeah, you know, hospitals need bigger payments because of higher labor costs, you know, and more people are using more healthcare since the pandemic. And this has raised pressure from Wall Street to keep a lid on spending. Like they're just like, yeah, the reason is people need to be paid, you know, shareholders need to be paid. And that's why we're squeezing everyone. That's why we're saying like, you know, you can't see the medical professional you want to see. And that's like in private fucking healthcare. Like remember they were crying rivers about like, oh, the government's going to tell you what doctor
God,
you can
yeah,
see and everything
right.
else. And, oh, you can keep your doctor and everything. Yeah, well, we still have private healthcare and you can't keep your doctor.
Yeah, no. How many times have I had to fucking change doctors because I changed insurance or just my doctor quits?
Yeah, and that just does not need to happen. You know, I, for one, don't... I wish there were fewer choices of doctors. I would like to be assigned to one. Just so I don't feel like I made a bad choice. That way I could just be like, well, it's the doctor. I mean, they gave me the doctor.
What are you going to do? It's the only guy in town.
Yeah, like...
I wouldn't mind that if the healthcare system, again, and the healthcare education system was better, you know?
Well, yeah, because they definitely aren't universally, like, tolerant and accepting of people and listening to different people's needs and shit like that.
Like, it's very weird. Like, I'll have conversations with Kyle, and he'll be like, I love my doctor. He, like, always helps and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, he's probably believed you every time you, like, had a problem, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, yes. And I'm like, that has not happened to me.
That's crazy.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I have to, like, fight half the time I'm at the doctor. I just now have a doctor who, like, listens to me and believes me and actually solves my problem. It's fucking life-changing. But even then, she's halfway across town, and it takes, like, a month to get in to see her, so... Not great. Not a great situation. I have really good fucking healthcare.
Man, you mentioned climate as being in this same death grip of capital. Of like, we have a very, you know, with healthcare, very obvious solution. Just fucking pay for it as a society. You're going to get better outcomes. Everyone knows it. We know it. That's why we campaign so hard against it, the government, you know, and the politicians and stuff. Because they know they're going to stop getting their bag if we ever do that. Climate, similar thing. It's like the dark side of not having a future vision is you don't even have like a vision of a future in which you survive. Because you're like not willing to put society together to like it'd be like if you sat down at the table to play D&D and you lay out a campaign. You're like, all right, big bad guy, you know, he's an asshole. He gives you this big speech about how he wants to destroy your whole realm, all the planes, everything. And your party's like, yeah, let's go back to the tavern. Let's hang
out. That's fine, actually.
Yeah, and they just chill. Like, they spend the rest of the time chilling. The rest of the campaign is them just kind of going about their lives while you narrate how the big bad just, like, tears apart their whole... Like, you're just actively refusing the call, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's what we're doing in climate. We know what is happening. We know the effects. We know the cause. We know the solution, but we're not going to do anything about it.
It's okay, though. Climate scientists and quote-unquote climate scientists can disagree on some of the issues involved there and still get along. So it's fine. There is this article in the New York Times with a lovely headline. He wants oil money off campus. She's funded by Exxon. They're friends.
One of these people should be murdering the other.
The two friends, both climate researchers, recently spent hours confronting the choices that will shape their careers and the world. Their ideas are very different.
Is the way they spell climate researchers for the ExxonMobil guy spelled like with the dollar sign as the S, you know?
It should be, yeah. And like the E be like the Euro sign.
Mm-hmm.
No, so the climate researcher guy is a lady, Rebecca Greckin. That's the Exxon, the oil company person. The guy, Yanai Kashtan, is the one who's like, that's fucked up.
No shit.
And it's very obvious stuff of just like, it's just, I don't know, it's such a liberal premise of, like, look at them, they're friends. They talk about
it. Still get along.
Yeah, they disagree about the issues, but, and it's... The article is kind of good because it essentially just puts to lie the oil company funded person sometimes, because they're talking to, you know, her friend who's like, I think that stuff, basically he says the climate science initiatives that like Exxon and the fossil fuel companies fund are billed as like climate science initiatives, right? So he was like, yeah, I worked on one of these. Working on my PhD, he was working on the technology called electrofuels. The big corporations, including fossil fuel companies, were promoting as a way to fight global warming. Basically, this would capture carbon dioxide, suck it out of the air, and combine it with hydrogen split from water using renewable energy and make liquid fuels for trucks and planes and shit, right?
Seems like a lot.
Okay, that's the problem, is that he says basically deploying it at scale does not make sense from an energy perspective. Capturing the carbon dioxide is very energy intensive. Producing the fuel is even more so. Like, it sucks, basically, he said. So he's like, yeah, I think that the industry funds these things as red herrings to distract from the obvious solution of burning less fossil fuels.
I mean, that's like making homemade bread for your PB&J, like just way more work.
Yeah. And I mean, they, you know, they do their kind of good journalistic, you know, duty of putting it in his mouth rather than just saying it. But like, you know, it's like, yes, I think so. I mean, that doesn't sound like it's a useful way to spend your time. And he's kind of like, yeah, I think that this, you know, the money that they give to people, you know, like my friend here or whatever, would be better spent, you know, doing actual climate science research, doing actual like
infrastructure changes.
Yeah. This gives them cover to say we're trying to work on these stupid technological solutions, and so we don't need to focus so much on just making societal changes.
No, I think that's the thing people are counting on now. It's like, oh, we'll just figure out infinite energy or something. But, you know, like people are really looking for a deus ex technica.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's Machina. I was trying to make a joke.
The thing is, they're too similar. Technica and
Machina. Yeah, that's the thing. That's why I had to clarify. I was like, well, I don't want people to think I don't know what it means.
Technica is not bad, though. It's kind of cool sounding.
It sounds like an anime. I'd watch it.
At some point, the quote-unquote climate scientist funded by... So it's like she doesn't work for Exxon. They're both at Stanford, I want to say. But her grant or something comes from fucking Exxon. They're like going for lunch somewhere and she's like driving them in her car, but she's being like self-conscious. Like, well, I don't usually drive my car, but I was bringing like recycling. It's just like, no one cares. Like, you can drive a car. Just don't fucking shill for the oil
don't
companies.
Don't work for Exxon.
Wild. But just, oh, but they can be friends. So it's good.
Fine. Don't worry about it.
And I don't know. It kind of, to me, goes in part and parcel with what we were talking about with just, like you said, there's no one can see a way out. I mean, plenty of people can, but there's no will to do any of the things that, I mean, I think the people with the most vision on that are people like strapping themselves to trees and like directly getting in the gears of the machine. I mean, at this point.
Dude, yeah, people blocking highways and shit, or you know, setting themselves on fire in the case of Palestine.
Yeah, Aaron Bushnell, that story was moving.
Yeah,
I don't know, what was your take on that?
It was tough to see the response, I guess, because you know, of course, a million people took it the wrong way of like, oh, you know, trying to say, you know, he had mental illness and things like that, and like his family came out against it and that kind of stuff. And of course, everyone's like, well, now we have to respect what the family says. And I'm like, actually, you don't. Like, he very explicitly said what he was trying to do, you know, yeah. Like seemed extremely clear of mind in that sense. Like, we can kind of take him on his word. Yeah. I mean, it's fucking powerful. I think one of the things he said, you know, right before, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something along the lines of like, if you ever wondered what you would do in, you know, in these really intense scenarios, like, you know, slavery or whatever it is, like, this is it. This is the answer. This is what you would have done. And that hits me. And like, that sits with me. And it's kind of horrifying.
Yeah. The very, you know, various different iterations of this type of meme of like, what did you do in the whatever war, grandpa or whatever? And you're like, well, I posted, you know, or something. It's what we're doing in terms of witnessing genocide. I was reading about his kind of background and stuff because he was in the Air Force, but basically he just, you know, he got really disillusioned with it. The Intercept had a really good piece together based on his like Reddit posts and LinkedIn's and stuff, like linked together his online stuff so they could see kind of what was going on in his life and stuff. And I mean, so he ends up joining the Air Force kind of out of financial need. He's Uber Eats driving for a while and then is like, you know, in financial distress, ends up signing with the Air Force. Is just kind of like, this is cool, sort of, you know, being a young guy sort of thing there. And then is quickly ends up kind of radicalizing and initially being posting about some like solidarity with prisoners, like, and like prison stuff, like, prison, I guess prison abolition is what that would fall under. And then moved toward, in 2023 about, Palestine and doing pro Palestine stuff and finding out more about that. And something he posted on the Air Force subreddit, a user asked veterans whether in hindsight they would still choose to join the military. And Bushnell replied, absolutely not. I've been complicit in the violent domination of the world, and I will never get the blood off my hands.
Wow.
Yeah, I already mentioned, you know, what would you do, you know, in the big moments, you know, which side would you be on, that sort of a thing. And, you know, one of the people who, you know, made a brave stand in his time was John Brown.
I honestly, that's what I thought of as well, of like willing to just fucking put it out there on the line and just do the damn thing.
Yeah. And of his famous words before his execution by the state for treason, for trying to spark a slave rebellion and liberate people. He said, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." A very similar sentiment, I think. John Brown didn't have as much of a personal guilt of that, although he realized he was, you know, realized that unless he did something like that, like literally do a slave rebellion,
he was still benefiting.
Right. Unless he like 100% took the side in the literal sense of the oppressed and like became of their number and like tried to free them by being with them. Unless he did that, he was going to be, like you said, benefiting. He was going to be still on that wrong side, even if he was like calling for change. You know, he had to make a complete separation from something he saw as evil. And I think that, I don't know, from what I was reading in this, it seemed like Bushnell struggled with that, of having been a part of that directly, as all of us are indirectly a part of it. But I think, you know, he had that direct experience and, I don't know, I would say succeeded in fully separating himself from that in a way that John Brown did.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the thing that lingers with me, and the question that lingers with me is like, what eventually pushes someone to make that separation? Like, it is such a there's no middle ground kind of thing once you get to that point. And obviously, yeah, he felt as a member of the military, he was more involved than maybe, you know, someone who's not. But still, like, you know, we're all involved in it in some way. We're all complicit in it. And if you don't think you are, you probably are, you know. And so everyone has to find that line of like, okay, here and no further. And like, that's such a difficult thing to answer, you know, like at what point do I say, fuck it, I'm quitting and this is all I'm working on. And, you know, I'm willing to, you know, lay my life on the line. Like, I'm not. And like, that's a thing I have to live with and recognize that like, I'm weak because of that, or I am not as committed, or, you know, like I'm not willing to do that. And it's a real cognitive dissonance for me because, again, like I feel like I am very happy in my personal life. I'm having a great fucking time, you know?
Yeah.
And to be able to hold that hand in hand with the suffering that is going on in the world is really challenging, to be able to say like, okay, this is going really well, this is going really shitty. And being able to recognize that like some of that is not a coincidence, you know, like some of that is like things are going well for you because you live in the Imperial Core and because mm-hmm. like, you know, this is where your money comes from, that kind of shit, right? But also like having enough, I guess, will to separate it enough so that I can just keep going. Like, I don't, it's just a very personal wrestling of issues that I've had to deal with of like, what do I do, you know?
You'd be surprised at how much you have in common with the religious.
Yeah, because there's always, I guess, that question of like, am I doing enough? Like,
yeah.
Do I need to quit my job and just go proselytize in 24/7?
Right, or even at the smaller scale. I mean, so, you know, where we attend, and you know, not completely frequently, but still fairly frequently, this guy, he's a pretty progressive pastor or what have you. But I mean, you know, he's preaching to a pretty affluent congregation. So I think that the challenge is a little bit more in that regard, because you've got to give this sort of weekly address of, you know, what are you doing for people? How are you helping people in a way that challenges but doesn't overthrow the comfortable lives that people are leading, that wants them, you know, it makes them want to do a little bit more, you know, but doesn't cause existential dread of like, yeah, should I drop everything and, you know, wear sackcloth and everything else and go be a hermit. And I think that when people meaningfully engage with, I think, not just Christianity, but any religious tradition, they're going to encounter this idea of I should be doing more. And then the moment will pass, the day will pass, they will leave service or whatever, and re-enter the world, and
they'll forget about
back
it.
To what they were doing. Yeah, like now it's time for lunch, you know, whatever, and they're gonna go out to the restaurant and hang out and go watch some football and just be back to their normal selves. And I know, I think that's a common, you know, that's something we have in common, I think, with that community.
I mean, is it a question then of like building those habits and like, you know, making a slow burn instead of just like a, oh yeah, I'm totally going to do this. And then just fucking forgetting. Like, I think that is a really tricky needle to thread in terms of like, again, where is that personal line?
Another kind of insight this would give you is in terms of historical revolutionary movements. When we think about them, you know, when we study them and stuff, sometimes it's disheartening. Like, shit, why didn't this strike like lead to all of it, right? Why didn't this uprising do the damn thing? It's because of the critical mass of people who are like us, or at least in our neighborhood of the spectrum of revolution, which is sympathetic, but takes a lot to get us off our ass. There's lots of people who want to see a ceasefire in Palestine. There's lots of people who want to see the Palestinian people have, you know, freedoms and have their own sovereignty restored to them. And then, you know, you can kind of like carve out, you know, smaller people who want, or groups of people who want specific things, what have you. But like, to do something about it, to suffer discomfort in your own life, to try to not to definitely change it, that's a pretty even exchange. Like, would you take a 1 in 10,000 chance that you would, you know, suffer a survivable wound to guarantee that the Palestinian cause would be victorious? Probably. I don't know. I would gamble that. Probably.
Totally. Yeah.
All right. But like, for the opportunity to, now my yes answer goes down by quite a bit. I don't know. You know, because like, that's the thing about any revolution is you don't know that it's going to work, but you're asked to risk not just a survivable wound, but risk it all.
Ugh. Yeah. It's a lot to ask. And again, especially for those of us who are living comfortable lives and are here in the States, you know, like, it's just, as much as we talk about how bad it is and all that shit, like, I am personally shielded from so much of that shit.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be really hard for me to say like, okay, like, now is enough of a moral imperative for me to like go fucking go in the streets or whatever. And it's just, there's so many ways that we can get derailed from that, you know?
For sure. And that's, I think, where kind of knowledge of theory can help you come to grips with that. Because so without any sort of theoretical grounding, the conclusion we've just come to is really bleak. It sucks. It's just like, well, yeah, the rich countries can't be counted on for shit. They're never going to change. And, you know, your best bet is that the rest of the world wipes them out, I guess, because they're stuck. Right. But if you step back and get kind of a perspective on it. All right. If we're saying Imperial Corps, obviously they're going to not want to change because we're there and we, you know, we do want to change, but we don't want to give stuff up to change it. So we're stuck. All right. Rest of the world, the weak points of capitalism, they're going to be changing. They're going to be doing revolutions. They're going to be building socialism where they can, and building up and gradually fighting wars of liberation, fighting wars of revolution, and building that alternative coalition. Right? So gradually they should be building up the alternative, and this alternative should get more and more viable. Eventually the siege should reverse. So right now we are, for example, besieging directly Cuba. You can argue about the particular merits of it, but like DPRK Vietnam and China, we're not like besieging them, but we're like, we treat them like shit. We say, oh, you guys suck, cause you're communists or whatever. Like, eventually that dynamic, if the people of the global South liberate themselves and build up socialism in their countries and start, you know, uniting and building up this alternative bloc, like they used to have with the Soviet Union and its socialist allies, then eventually they should end up the dominant force and the Imperial Corps should be the one that's increasingly isolated. I think the logical conclusion to that is that if you start whittling it down from the most, you know, the least powerful to the up to the most powerful of the imperial countries, eventually you're going to be stuck with just, you know, Fortress America. And that's it.
America stands alone.
Yeah, America. Yeah, eventually America will stand alone, but I think in two key ways. One, the increasing strength of the socialist world. Not military strength, a part of it, but like...
just the sheer mass of people who are on board.
The mass of people, the quality of life, like that is going to become the better alternative. And increasingly, because of its declining ability to exploit the rest of the world at the barrel of a gun, the Imperial Corps, its standard is going to be declining. And so increasingly, what was a terrible proposition of give up the heights of privilege to cast in your lot with, you know, the oppressed people of the world, and you're like, I don't know, they're oppressed. Like, I don't necessarily want to be like them.
That sounds pretty hard.
Now, the calculus will have shifted. And so, I mean, in that way, you can have some sort of hope if that process does end up playing out that way. But the process is not some abstract, you know, breath of history. We're not... Yeah, this is where maybe we depart from the religious tradition. We're not clay vessels breathed into the breath of life. You know, this is history is made up of people's actions. And so that march of the socialist countries advancing and all that stuff is not just going to fucking happen. I mean, it's going to take lots and lots of people fighting against the empire, you know, dying in that cause. I mean, I think that even actions that, because, I mean, you know, Aaron Bushnell didn't directly change any policy with his action. But, I mean, I think that this is going to be not in the sense of people are going to say, I want to do that, too. But it is going to be inspirational, I think. And it's going to take a lot of people taking it as seriously as he did. And people willing to do what they can. Yeah, because I think, you know, I'm trying to give this big, huge history picture of it. But I also want to refocus on what you said about, like, what do I do specifically? I think that we have to be okay with, similar to that church tradition of, like, I'm not going to go be a hermit, but I do want to try to do more nice shit for people in my life. Like, we have to also be okay with, like, what is our direct role going to be for now? Like, and yeah, that can change over time. It's not like you're going to, you know, decide today, I'm going to, you know, be, you know, talk to people on a podcast or something, or I'm going to join an organization and that's going to be the extent of my contribution ever. Like, you can start small and grow, you know, and that's it. And you should be, I think, okay with not necessarily preaching the coming class war in the streets. You can take intermediate steps, and yeah, maybe it's kind of good that we wrestle with, could I be doing more? You know, we continue to do that in our lives, so it drives us, but...
probably a good question to ask.
Yeah. To know that you should be doing more and not, or how was it that Mao put it, right? Like, to live in a way that no one can tell that you're a communist is itself a form of liberalism, so don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. And I find that increasingly hard to do, so at least I'm on the right track there.
There you go.
Just when I, like, meet people, it's really hard for me not to be like, so anyway, I'm a communist.
That's good. People know.
Yeah, yeah.
We always end up somewhat philosophical or jaded and stuff like that.
Yeah, I feel like I went to church. I went to commie church.
I forgot that I was thinking about this earlier this week. Of something, I saw it in a TikTok video or something, but they were talking about the notion of, like, probably any religious tradition, but I know it from Christianity. It's encouraged to study, like, you know, to read the Bible. I think this was in the context of Lent and stuff. And it's like, yeah, you want to, you know, be reading the Bible more and more familiar with that, because the idea of this study is that, like, the more familiar you are with, you know, the teachings and shit like that, like, the more you're going to see it in your everyday life. There's like a good analogy to draw between that and theory, or socialist, communist, anarchist, whatever stripe you want to be. with knowing like how shit works. The more you know about how the economy works, how class warfare works, how all of it, all the theoretical parts, how the processes of history unfold and everything, the more things in your life will make sense according to that.
I agree. I mean, we talk about that all the time too, of there is a shift when you start learning more about this kind of stuff, where you can see those parallels, like in so many areas of life, of you know, healthcare or public transit or whatever it is that you are engaging with, you can probably draw a straight line back to capitalism when you're thinking about why it sucks.
You will end up feeling like you're the only one, like you're crazy, just like the super Biden people were, mm-hmm. but you will actually be the one with the knowledge.
Yeah. It's a struggle, and you know, honestly, as someone who runs the social, it's a struggle a lot of people are dealing with in terms of like, what the fuck do I do? So I guess find something you can do consistently. I don't know. I've been getting back into like exercising a little bit this year, and I have to fucking trick my little lizard brain into it because I have a very fraught relationship with it. And so I have to find ways to be like, okay, I'll try to be consistent, but I can't make too many rules because then I'm like, ugh, rules, and I don't do it. And mm-hmm. So like maybe there's something I can learn from that process into here of like, okay, what's something that I can do that is like small but achievable, but will still make me be like, yeah, I did a thing.
Yeah.
So who knows?
One of the great things I think you can do that's very small, but does get you motivated or at least undemotivated, like less depressed about everything, and certainly less believing that you're the only crazy person out there. One of the things is you're already doing is tuning in to like-minded people.
Yeah, that does help. It really does. Oh my gosh. Can you imagine if one of us wasn't communist? Who the fuck would we talk to?
I'd just be bothering my friends or something, I guess.
I know. I think I would just drive Kyle up a wall just trying to convert him all the time. Like, no, you got to listen to this.
Yeah, oh, that would not work.
That would be weird.
You know, this is one form, of course, but other, you know, getting in touch with other people to some extent, virtually, in the real, you know, sphere of the world, however you want to do it. Maybe learning who your neighbors are, depending on your area, might be, you know, could prove interesting in that regard. You could be surprised. But I don't know. It's part of like that longer term project of like building mutual aid and solidarity and shit like that ultimately will involve interacting with the people around you. But I don't know. I don't like to advocate that as a full thing because like, I'm a very shy person and I understand people being like, I don't want to fucking do that.
I don't want to go up there.
You know, it's maybe one day, but you don't have to set it like as an immediate goal.
Yeah. Yeah. There's ways to work up to that, I'm sure. All right, man. I'm all philosophicaled out.
Yeah, I didn't even have anything to drink and I was able to wax.
Yeah. Good job.
Wax about the Church of Communism, or whatever the hell. There you go.
Okay, next week, we're doing a little history.
Yeah, it could be a little history, it could be a big history.
We don't know yet.
I'm still in the research phase, the Wikipedia dives on the Mongolian People's Republic. So Mongolia, but in like socialist times.
I don't know anything about it.
From 1924 to 1992, they were totally socialist, you know, to varying degrees and shit like that, but we'll talk
obviously
about it.
Okay, great. We'll find out. How socialist were they? Were they cool?
Well, they were Mongolian, so like, yes,
they were probably chilly. Oh, terrible. Okay, we'll tune in next week for that.
All right, I'll try to learn how to do the throat singing thing, too. I probably will not succeed.
You could probably learn that in a week. That seems easy.
What if I did? I came on here and we did like the intro, and I'm just like, whoa,
just yo, immediately.
Whoa. Yeah, that would be badass.
It'd be insane.
I might quit the podcast to be a Mongolian throat singer if that happens.
If that is like a latent talent of yours, that like this is how you find out, I support that.
People are like, he's not only got a calming voice, but he's also a good Mongolian throat singer.
He's got two of them now. It'd be so weird. Well, we'll find out if that's what happens next week.
All right. I'll talk to you then. And probably in between, but you know.
Probably, because we're like related.
Yeah. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey there, comrades. Just jumping in to remind you of all of our social media. We are on Twitter at Teach Communism, Instagram at Teach Me Communism. You can shoot us an email. That's teachmecommunism@gmail.com. Any of those places are good to send us an episode suggestion or a question, anything you think would be useful feedback for us, or just your admiration. If you want to admire us in a public manner, and you should, you can go to Apple Podcasts to give us a review. It is the best way to help people find the show. Love when people write and review us. Please do both. We are also on YouTube, if that's how you prefer to listen to podcasts, or if you know someone that's the only way they'll listen to podcasts, send them to our page. And we have a Patreon. For $5 a month, you get access to our notes for each week's episode, including the backlog of notes, which is a very handy resource for up-and-coming commies. And at the end of the year, all of the funds from Patreon will be given to local mutual aid in the DFW area. So, ain't going to line our pockets. Finally, we have merch. Check us out at TeePublic. You can find shirts and I believe also stickers and magnets and all kinds of fun stuff, with catchphrases from the show or episode art, stuff like that. The link to that store is in the show notes, so check that out. Okay, that's all the internet. Join us next time for another episode of Teach Me Communism, where the class struggle is always in session. Bye, y'all.